Hi, I'm Ken. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm as surprised as you guys that I'm here. One of the things that I always carry in my wallet is this little let go and let God card. And it kind of sums up where my life is right now. And on the other side are the principles of the program. And oftentimes you'll go to meetings and you'll hear people say principles before personality. And I'm always surprised to find out how many people don't know what the principles of the program are. And they're derived directly from the steps, you know. So if you have a pencil and you want to jot these down, if you already know them, no big deal. But the first principle is honesty. And that's derived from the first step. And the second principle is hope. And that's derived from the second step. And the third principle is faith. Third step. And the fourth step is courage. And the fifth step is integrity. And the sixth step is willingness. And the seventh step is humility. And the eighth step is brotherly love. And the ninth step is justice. And the tenth step is perseverance. And the 11th step is spiritual awareness. And the 12th step is service. And if you've been around a while and you already know that, that's terrific. But I'm always impressed with the number of people who come to AA for years who, when they say principles before personalities, they look at each other and say, what are the principles? And so at least now we've been through that once. The deal with me today will be very simple. I'm going to count on you guys to give me your input and your experience, strength, and hope, too, as we go through these steps. And there's a lot of philosophy and philosophical stuff that go with the steps depending on who does them. And I was told early on, and it's what I believe today, and I believe it not because I was told it, but because it's been my experience. I'm a big doubt guy, and I think when you come into Alcoholics Anonymous, the more doubt you have, the better off you are. If you just acquiesce to what somebody tells you, then it becomes philosophical, and it's not your experience. But once you go through something and it becomes your experience, then you have a sense of that truth. You know, you're able to hang on to it in tough times. If it's just what somebody else told you and you haven't experienced it, then it's just a philosophy. You know, it relates to the communists taking over in South America. And they said, we're going to make you guys all communists. And somebody said, well, what's a communist? And the fellow said, well, if you have two houses, you give one to the state and you keep one. And the guy said, I can be a communist. And he said, if you have two cars, you give one to the state and you keep one. The guy said, I can make a good communist. And then finally he said, if you have two chickens, you give one to the state and you keep one. The guy said, whoa, I got two chickens. You know, it's like when you're giving stuff away that you don't have, it's very philosophical. It's when it gets down to what's really yours. So what I was told early on, and which, as I said, has been my experience, is that the primary purpose of these steps is to get into a position where you're gently led back to yourself as to who you really are. And then you get to know yourself for the first time. Most of the folks that I meet, in fact, all of the folks that I meet who come into Alcoholics Anonymous come with a make-believe self, somebody they made up. It's like a dream. An ego is like a dream. And it has to be smashed. You know, Chuck used to talk about ego deflation, and almost all of the people who had anything worthwhile, as far as I'm concerned, to say on this topic, always talked about ego deflation. And that's what these steps do. The thing with an ego is, an ego cannot stand up to fact. Since it's mythical and make-believe, it's based on illusion. And it can't stand up to fact. And what the steps do is they introduce fact into our lives. The more honest we can get about who we really are, then the less need we have to pretend to be someone else. And then you get very, very comfortable with yourself. And it doesn't make any difference what's going on around you. You're not impacted the same way you once were. Now, if that sounds like a mouthful, it is. And we'll go through these steps. And if there's any questions that you guys have, you know, please raise them, because I have no set agenda here today. I was asked to do this, and I'm doing it. And I'm always privileged to participate in these things. But it's a learning experience for me, too, because you guys have your own little stories and your own little experiences. And the more of that flavor we can get into it, the more worthwhile this thing will be. So let's just start with step one. Someone want to read it? Who has a book?
Hello. Oh,
hi, Jim. Step one, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable.
Okay. What does that relate to anybody? What does that mean? My life is unmanageable, and I'm an alcoholic. What does that mean? What does that mean to you?
It means I need help.
Okay. All right. Okay. Anyone else? Yes.
Being an alcoholic.
Yeah.
My life is unmanageable. I can't think of the programs in my psycho war.
Okay.
Well, things weren't too
good. Good. You weren't on a winning streak either. That's good. You, somebody here was saying something. Okay. So the general consensus is that it's not working. And if you can get behind what makes that not working is the fact that in the beginning, and the thing that you have to either accept or doubt, and you can doubt it as much as you want, and that is the fact that this is a spiritual program. That means, it's, you know, we can't say parts of it are spiritual. The entire program is spiritual. So that means you're going to have to start to get in touch with not only who you are, but you're going to have to develop a concept or whatever you want to say, perception of what this higher power is. And you're not going to be able to do for yourself alone simply because you've had no success doing that. You have no track record doing that. So the deal is that you admit that your life is unmanageable and that you are alcoholic. And alcoholism and alcoholic kind of go together. You know, somebody said the ism part of this means incredibly short memory. You know, alcoholics can go out and redo the same event over and over and over again expecting what? Different results. Okay. You know, and yet it's like we do the same thing, and as we go through the process of doing, our mind, which is basically is in opposition to what we're trying to accomplish, is telling us that it's going to be okay, and the reality is it hasn't been okay. So you come in here, and somebody reads this for the first time, and you hear that your life is unmanageable. Something has to be done about it, and whatever has to be done about it falls outside the realm of what you can do. How many feel as though when you come to an AA meeting, some old timer told me this, and, you know, we'll throw it out, is that he said, if you come to an AA meeting and you sit through it and you ask someone to be a sponsor, you've taken the first three steps. I'll say that again. You come to an AA meeting, you sit through it, and you ask someone to be a sponsor, you've taken the first three steps. Jim?
My name's Jim Alcoholic.
Yeah,
that's essentially what happened to me. I was solving my problems with booze.
Mm-hmm.
And then the thing that I loved so much stopped working.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know what to do. I had been sentenced years before that to come to AA through the court system. And I came, so at least I knew where to come back mm-hmm. to when I wanted to come, when I needed to come. I didn't like being sentenced mm-hmm. to AA. But when I found you know, that nothing in my life was working, I knew where to go back to. You know, I heard the we right away. I heard the 90 and 90, and I asked about the 90 and 90, and they said that I didn't know anything about what they were doing there, and that I had been out doing something that wasn't working for me. And you go ahead and sit down, hopefully in the front, and, you know, find somebody that would be a sponsor to me, that I liked what he had.
And take the truth. How many of you generally accept the idea that alcohol is but a symptom of a much deeper problem? Is there anyone who has any argument with that? You know, because this is the whole deal here. This is to parse this stuff out. So we're all starting with the basic premise then that it's a symptom. And it's a symptom of what? Why do people drink? You know, they give a great explanation in the doctor's opinion as to why people drink. People drink because they like the effect. They like what it does to them, for them, whatever terminology you want to use. But if you were happy with who you are, would you want to change you? You drink to do what? To affect a change. And that means you're not happy with who you're starting out with. I mean, it's so much of this stuff is so simple. that you could actually get through it in 10 minutes if you could just read it the way it's written, accept it, and introduce it into your life. But no, we got to have more and more about less and less until we all get totally confused, you know. And thank God there's a big book. I'm more and more convinced as I go to step study meetings and as I go to regular meetings that the whole purpose of the meeting is to so confuse you that you have to buy a book and read it, you know. That's the deal, you know, because otherwise you're just getting things that a lot of times at meetings, things are said, and I've done this myself, and they sound real good. But then as I get to experience them, I find out that they're not my experience. And my life is unmanageable in the sense that oftentimes I try to emulate what somebody else, copy what someone else is doing, and in the process, I lose more and more track of who I am. There's a lot of things that I grew up with that I basically do not believe today. Now, I'm not faulting anyone for that. I'm just saying that as I get older, I find out that a lot of the things which caused me to be uncomfortable with me because I wasn't able to live up to them, I just never believed in the first place. And it's taking me years and years into sobriety to come to that realization. Some people can do it real fast. But it wasn't like I'm at war with anyone. It's just that the fact that I never knew I didn't know. You know, it takes you a long time to know that you don't know. Because you're working under, when I first got here, and I think it's true of almost anyone in the room, our lives had become so unmanageable that we had created so much wreckage that we thought that wreckage was the problem. You know, I related to coming down the highway and you're driving in a station wagon. And whatever you're done using or destroying, you throw behind you. All your garbage is thrown in the back of the station wagon. And AA is hitting the brakes. You know? And all that stuff comes forward. And it starts banging off the windshield, hitting you in the head and all around you. And the reality is for you is that this is the problem. You know, the divorce, the bankruptcy, the lack of money, whatever it is, the bad relationships with family. So you start to deal with that. And that's the most obvious. That's what looks like it was most unmanageable when you first get here. But as you're here a while, you realize the problem was and is the driver. The rest of that stuff just came about because of the driver. Okay, so we admit that we're alcoholics and that our lives have become unmanageable. Anything else to be said about that? Anybody have anything that they think we should touch on before we move on? Okay, step number two. First thing you read it, right here. Sure. Well, what do you think? Okay. And where do you think, you know, it's real hard. My personal belief, and you guys don't have to buy this, if you don't, you're not offending me, but as I'm here longer, what I have come to realize for me is that my deal was totally spiritual right from the get-go, even though I didn't realize it. I believe that I was delivered into this world, and I see enough babies at meetings, that I was delivered into this world okay. And I watch kids. To me, they're in perfect meditation all the time. And that doesn't mean they're thinking. They're just doing. And they're enjoying. And they're relaxed. And they don't know about words like right and wrong. And this was touched on by, I think, Eileen last night, and I firmly agree with it, that somewhere down the line in life, you have to get away from words which have become so familiar that you use them and you don't realize how they're affecting you. Words like good and bad, right and wrong. Really what it comes down to, some things work for you today, and some things don't work for you today. And some things you can do today with ease, you may not be able to do in a couple of months or a couple of years. Simply because as you grow spiritually, your own perception of what life is all about changes. In the beginning, it's very selfish and self-centered. I relate it to putting air in a balloon. When the baby is born, there's no air in the balloon. The balloon is at rest. And along the line, what do? We inflate the balloon. We start to tell this kid his name. He has a country. He has a religion. He has a nationality. And the more that we tell him or her, what happens to them? They get broken off from the whole. I looked up one time because, again, I'm unscarred by education, but the words whole, W-H-O-L-E, healing and holy all come from the same root word. When you're whole, you're holy. And when you're holy, you're whole. And that doesn't mean by some standard out there coming in. It means from some standard in here coming out. And so when you say, was it ever manageable? I believe in the beginning when I was totally unconscious, it was manageable. But as I became more and more conscious of all these differences that people gave me, I call them unsolicited gifts, then what happened was I became more and more apart. And you hear the word remember? Did you ever hear that word remember? Okay. To me, remember means I was separated from the whole. And now being remembered, I'm joined with the whole again. That's why you hear people say things like, I came into AA, and maybe you've never heard this, I hear it all the time, but I hear people say, I came into AA and I came to a few meetings and I felt what? What's the word? At home or connected. I felt part of. In other words, suddenly I felt part of something again. For so long I was out there on the periphery, operating on my own. And I was thinking and creating the illusion that I was unique and different. And as I got here and I stayed here longer and became part of the whole, I reached a greater comfort level. Because now I'm with people where, after a while, I was at a meeting not too long ago, there were a lot of old-timers. Now, old-timers to me doesn't mean just people with a lot of years. It's people who come to meetings who are very active. And the conversation was going on, and I was laughing to myself. And why I was laughing is that there was no judgment and stuff. People were saying things. You could say whatever you wanted to say. And it was like, oh, yeah, you know, I experienced that once. And it was like no big harshness with one another. And when I first got here, that was not the way I looked at life. It was, I looked at life like, this is right and this is wrong. If you do this, you're wrong. And if you don't do this, you're wrong. And so, in answer to your question, was it ever manageable? For me, I believe when I was just a baby, it probably was. But as I learned to be separated, it became more and more difficult. I hope I didn't answer your question. Because I'm a firm believer that you got to maintain a high degree of doubt here. You have to keep doubting and doubting and doubting and doubting and doubting until you run out of doubt. Until you can just say, glad that's over.
When you run out of doubt.
Yeah. When
you finally run out of doubt.
Uh-huh. That's the question. Do you ever run out of them? Or when you run out of them?
When you finally run out of doubt.
It's when you find yourself in a position where you realize that no matter how thick the coin is, there's two sides to the coin. And that the extremes of things are what makes anything healthy. And that you've got to be exposed to the extremes of life. You know, this business of coming here and trying to live in an isolated world, we don't live that way. So to answer your question, hopefully without answering it, is the fact that you do what you have to do until you get comfortable with you. The acid test here to me is always the same. If you're happy, joyous, and free, you're doing what's okay for you. And if you're not happy, joyous, and free, if you're at odds with everyone and everything, sometime or most of the time, then for some reason you're not happy with you yet. And the reality of life is that you've been trained, and I've been trained the same way, by schooling and so forth, as limited amount that I have, is that to look for what? The answer has got to be, if I can just arrange this. The book talks about what? If I could just manage better, then it would all work. And the deal is, no one's ever going to be able to manage like that. That's why we surrender to a higher power. Anything else on step one? God, we'll be here longer than I thought.
Hey, Tim, I'm an
Tim,
alcoholic.
Yes.
It would seem to me that you're always going to have doubts. You're always going to be not totally whole, that we are not saints, and that the doubt is a symptom of our lack of wholeness, and this program teaches us to deal with the doubt and to overcome those doubts rather than to simply sweep them or throw them in the back of the car, as you were saying.
Yeah.
So I would not tell someone that they're going to reach a point where they will have no doubt.
No, hopefully not. Because, you know, if you look at everything in nature, what does it do? It evolves. There's nothing in nature that stands still. It's always in a state of what? It's always in a state of change. While we sit here, we're in a state of change. I'm not a big biological guy, but I know what. Cells are being created. We're changing as we sit here. Nothing is constant. One of the greatest stories I ever heard was somebody walked up to Buddha and he slapped him. And Buddha said, "Is that all you have to say?" And the guy who went home that night, he must have been alcoholic, he went home that night and he thought, "Oh my God, I had one chance to meet this spiritual man and I slapped his face when I met him." So he went back the next day and he said, "Please excuse me." He said, I didn't mean that. He said, "I apologize." And Buddha's response was of a man who was spiritually together. He said, "The man whose face you slapped no longer exists." And obviously, the man who slapped his face no longer exists. There's no state of isness. Everything is in flux. People worry about there and then. There is no there and then. There's only here and now. When you get to there and then, it's here and now. So we're on the same wavelength. Is that there's always going to be doubt, but that doubt does not corrupt your being whole. You can doubt and be whole at the same time, as long as it doesn't what? Force you to go back to try to escape through drink or something else. And that's what we'll talk about here, drinking. Anyone else? Anything on step one? Okay, now my fear is we're not going to get through in time. All right. Okay. Step two. Supposing you read step two.
My name is Hans Wetter. I'm an alcoholic. Can't you believe that a power greater than ourselves can destroy us?
Okay. Now that makes the presumption of what? what's implied in that?
Crazy.
That somehow, you know, your attic is empty. You know, like you got birds missing from your nest, okay? It's like you're playing with a warped puck. It's you know, there's something missing. And that something that we're missing, again, always to me relates back to, if you heard me last night, is that the more that we're always looking for, and we don't even know it, is the introduction or the association or the connection with what? God, exactly, God. And God, from the Greek, G-O-D, means that which is. God is just that which is. And when people say, "Well, I have a trouble with that concept of God." Okay, that which is. Do you believe that you're the greatest source of power? Then there may be something else. And just leave that door open. It's like when people say, "I don't want to take the steps because I don't believe in them." It doesn't say you have to believe in them. It just says what? Take them thoroughly. If you take them thoroughly, everything else will work out. You just take them thoroughly. Okay, so you're a little out of your range right now because you're Bellevue material, as we used to say in New York. Like, he's Bellevue material, meaning that this guy's not all there. Even though he's all here, he's not all there. Okay, so you have to be restored to sanity. Now, let's just connect two and three. How does that come about? What do you do next in step three? What?
Make a decision.
Okay. Make a decision. That's a great word. Make a decision to do what? Turn your will and your life over to the care of God as you understand it. So that those two steps, actually those three steps, the old timers used to say things like, "I can, he can, I think I'll let him." How many times have you heard that? And that's basically what it is. And it's like you're at a junction in your life. You know, and the book says we stood at the turning point. And it's real hard to sometimes get people to understand that we stand at the turning point each and every day. Each and every moment, we're standing at the turning point. And it's like, what are we going to do? Are we going to follow what we feel we should do, or are we going to do what's convenient? And a lot of times, we do what's convenient. And we know down deep. No one has to tell you when you're off your game. You know it down deep. You know? Down in our area in San Diego, there's a little seaport village, and the kids fly kites there. And I love kids because they have the best answers for everything. And one day, several years back, there was a kid flying a kite, and there were low clouds. And I said to him as I walked by, he was about 7 or 8, I said, how do you know your kite's still up there? Because it was above the clouds. And without hesitating, he looked up and he said, because I can feel the pull of it. And that's what happens in life. When you're doing what works for you, and when you're doing what you know to the best of your ability God wants you to do, you feel the pull of it. No one has to tell you. And when you're not doing that, the pull is just as hard. No one has to sit down and say, hey, you know, you're not doing what makes you feel comfortable. You know that already. So the two of those go together. I always feel that, and I'm not saying anyone I know has ever been able to do it, but if you're able to make that decision in step three to turn your will and your life over to the care of God as you understand Him, then from that point on, I believe it's implied, and I'll throw this out because you may not have the same belief, but I believe it's implied you never have to make a judgment again. I'm not saying I don't, but I'm saying it's implied you never have to make a judgment again. Because if you feel you're doing God's will, then words like right and wrong shouldn't come in. It's like whatever's happening is supposed to be happening. Is that too simplistic? Some of you are smiling. What do you think? Well, you know, what's your feeling on that? Yeah, I'm sorry.
I'm Linda, I'm an alcoholic. And it's my understanding that once I do make that decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God, as I understand it, at that moment that I do that, that I take that third step, prayer, my life is no longer my own business. It's done. And I don't have to constantly go back and repeat and repeat and repeat and ask it unless I feel I haven't done it right. But at that moment you were talking about the here and now, when the here and now came and I made that decision and I took that action, my life was no longer mine. You know, I wasn't in charge of it. I had a new manager and I did what felt good in here. That has since changed over the years in that my perception of God, which we'll get into later, has changed. My understanding of God has changed and grown. Because, first of all, I've got Him inside. And that's what I did when I took that third step prayer. I invited my God inside. And because I truly believe that we have all the answers inside of us. We just don't know how to tap into them. And by inviting God in and that light, and that light is going to pull them in. Okay. So that's my feeling on the third step.
I like that too, but, you know, it sounds so good, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
God, this is all God's business. So when I get up in the morning, I'll just tiptoe through life. Sounds a little spacey, doesn't it? And yet, you know, I've been around people. I had a sponsor who used to bring me to his house. He had a slew of kids. And I had a chance to watch him do the husband routine and the father routine and to go to work every day. That was a big thing with me, getting up and going to work, you know. It was like we made money the old-fashioned way. We took it. And it was like, now it was like going and doing something, you know, being productive, getting there at a certain time and then doing a day and then leaving at a certain time. Very difficult. But when you watch someone do it, it's a lot easier because you know it can be done. Somebody had their hand up back there. Yes, sir.
My name is Sir, I'm an alcoholic.
Yes, sir.
Speaking for myself, when I turned my will and my life over to the care of God, it turned into be a full-time job, not a part-time job. And along with that came my traditional faith. And the faith part of it is that if I truly trust and believe that God is doing for me what I could never do for myself, then the faith that I have in Him will lead me to believe that it's His decision, not mine.
Okay. Did you guys all hear, did you ever hear that acronym for faith? It's Further Adventures in Trusting Him. You know, and that's what you do. You know that there is stuff going to happen, and the idea is that it's a trust. You know, I think one of the words we never or seldom, I shouldn't say never, but we seldom talk about in AA, and it's probably one of the greatest words, is patience. I don't ever hear meetings on patience. I hear them on relationship and all this other, but I never hear anyone talk about patience. But if you can be patient, patient implies trust and faith and all those other things. Because what you're saying is, I'm going to allow this entity, however I perceive it, to do for me in his time schedule and not in mine. And that's trust and faith all tied into one. Instead of like, I'm going to ramrod this through, you know. And so patience. There's a big book, I believe it's the original big book, and I know it's used in the Christian world, and it's called the Bible. And in there's a great quote that I read over and over and over again. In fact, I have it on bookmarkers, and I have it in my house all over the place. And it says, "Be still and know that I am God." And that's the greatest thing in the world to do, and that is to be still. The tendency, and I don't know about you guys, but when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, being still for this alcoholic was a death-defying act. You know, I didn't know how to be still. And just being still and allowing life to happen and watching it happen, being aware of it, not just letting things happen around you, but being totally aware. You know, when I first got here, it was like someone woke me up from a bad dream. It had been like I was asleep for years. I was sleepwalking through life because people would say things and I would say, gee, you know, I really believe that myself. And yet I haven't been doing it. And yet it seems so simple. How did I forget? How did I let that get away from me? And the deal was that I was anesthetized. You know, I was taking something that supposedly was going to make me feel better and it made me feel worse. And I became a sleepwalker. And what AA did for me was it was a good slap in the face and said, wake up, there's a lot going on here. And that's what that step three did to me. It said, made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood him. And that's what really helped me in AA. Not just the third step, but the way it was written. Because for the first time that I could recall, someone was saying to me, go and get your own experience about God. Up until then, I was raised in a household where I was told what I had to believe. And if I didn't believe it, then I was somehow bad or out of step or was sinful or whatever. And for the first time, I heard AA say to me, go and get your own experience about God. The door's open. You go through it and find out for yourself. And for the first time, I was allowed to get my own experience. I looked up a lot of words. I looked up the word sin because I heard so much about sin. And sin from the Hebrew means to forget. It means forget. We made it into something terrible, but it just simply means to forget. And when I looked at it, when I sinned, that's what happened. I forgot. I went ahead and did something based on selfishness and self-centeredness that had nothing to do with remembering God. I forgot God. God was in another place. And I went and I did what was selfishly in my own best interest, or I thought in my own best interest. So two and three there are kind of just intertwined, and you make a decision. And that's just it. You make a decision that I'm going to turn to the best of my abilities, my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand him or her. And don't get bogged down with what this entity is. Don't get bogged down. We live in a miracle and we try to figure out how we got there. Just enjoy the miracle. Just enjoy the miracle. It's like, ha. And look around at what nature does. It's always in process. You go into a home and you see plastic flowers. That's not made by nature. It's us trying to do that. Hold something stationary. And that's what step three was to me. I remember a fellow sharing one time that made a lot of sense to me. He said, you know, step three is like a rose. And I said, how is that? And he said, a rose gives off its fragrance no matter who's walking by. And that's the way God is. God gives off his fragrance no matter who's walking by. And whether or not you want to stop to smell that is your business. But the fragrance is there to be smelled. It's available. And if you want to tap into it, fine. And if you don't, fine. But it's there. It's ever-present. And I like that. And he also said, roses, and they use this saying in Al-Anon. Are there any Al-Anons in the room? They use it in Al-Anon. They say, roses have thorns. You know, I think it's page 100 in the little Odette book that said, even roses have thorns. And the deal is that as you get closer and closer to an understanding and an acceptance of this power in your life, things get sticky because you have to let go of stuff. And letting go of that stuff is very difficult because somehow we've incorporated into our thinking that it's worthwhile holding on to. I heard a mystical fellow one time speaking, one of these spiritual gurus, the Dalai Lama. And he had a great little deal. People went to L.A. when he was kicked out of Tibet. They had him up in L.A. Everything comes to L.A. eventually. And they had the Dalai Lama, who had just been kicked out of Tibet by the Chinese, and he had fled from India, and they were selling tickets $100 a pop to go hear the Dalai Lama. And before the Dalai Lama, they had all these guys like Bob Mathias and all these motivational guys. And they spoke for half hour, 40 minutes. And the only way some of them could have said less is if they talked longer. And then up came the Dalai Lama, and he had on his little orange robe, and he shuffled out to the microphone, and he looked at the audience, and he said, "Our primary purpose for being on this earth is to help one another." And then he turned around, went to sit down. And then it was like he had an afterthought, and he came back to the microphone, and he said, "Some of us, because of our current nature, cannot do that. So our primary purpose is not to hurt anyone." And he went and he sat down. And he smiled. And people were going, $100? I drove all the way up from San Diego, paid $100 to hear this bozo say, "Our primary purpose is to help one another, and if I can't do that, not to hurt anyone?" And I was sitting there thinking, gosh, you know, like, he just did a third step. He was just surrendering himself, saying, "That's what I'm here for." And it was so simple. But the mind of the human being says, what? For $100, we should get a lot more. We should get a handout. There should be at least one or two handouts for $100. And that's the way we equate things to the dollar value. And it's just amazing. We have two different economics. Some people have the economics of the heart, what goes on inside, and the rest of us are making change. And it's like, which, you know, sooner or later you have to decide which one you want to live your life in. And I realize you have to have a little bit of the one, but it's in most cases, it's become our primary focus. Okay, anything else on step three? Yes, sir.
I'm Bill. I'm an alcoholic.
Yes, Bill.
What do you say to a person who has a background like mine, who kind of a dysfunctional alcoholic home, where you there was no redemption? I don't know if they actually said that, but it was certainly implied. And even a God who was always focusing on your negative thoughts. I wasn't a real bright kid, but I used to think, how can I not think these negative thoughts?
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
Sure.
So I kind of gave up on that. I was a real little kid. And I had a real struggle with that step three today. I kind of, you know, I think, well, maybe I better pull the string and reel it in and do it myself for a while. Let go and reel it in, let go. Well, what do you say to somebody like that?
Well, you know, I grew up in a very similar kind of home. I was the youngest of seven. We were an Irish Catholic family. We lived in the city. I think if you're Irish Catholic and you live in New York or some major city, you should start in AA about six. You know, they should just enter you in some juvenile program to get you ready for AA, because if you don't get there, you should have, you know, because you got so much guilt, you know. I remember the first time discovering myself in the bathtub, and I was thinking, boy, I wonder if God... You know, I wonder if Dad knows about this. You know, like, this was, like, amazing. But then the next thought was, that's so terribly bad. But, you know, I had a guy who, my sponsor was a very simplistic kind of guy, and I loved him, and I still love him, and we're still in contact. And he's like this big Irishman who used to smoke cigars, and his name is Corrigan, and he owns a plumbing business, and on his trucks it has Wrong Way Corrigan, you know. Only underneath it says, I'm Right Way Corrigan, you know. And the deal is that, he said to me one time when we got into this kind of a discussion, he said, look at it this way. Do you believe in God, period? And I said, yeah. He said, do you believe in the devil? I don't know. There's a lot of this stuff I thought I believed in. I'm not too sure. He said, okay, here's God. Here's the devil. God made the devil. This is heavy stuff, so follow this closely. Okay. The devil came from here, okay, if you want to believe the story. Let's just take the story the way we're told. The devil. Now they're in competition. Do you think God's going to lose to the devil? Do you think more people are going to go to hell than to heaven? Do you think God, who made up the game, is going to lose everybody? Come on. Is that the way you would make up the game if you had all the power? Yeah, I think I'll get beat in this game 3-1. You know? No. It's like we are all going to end up back where we started at. We may go over some paths, and I don't understand it, and I don't have to. I just know that there's a process. And that's why I believe God and love are synonymous, because I come to AA meetings, and through love, I see God. And I don't have to talk about nuclear energy or all of this stuff that I don't have any big understanding of. I talk about love. To me, love is the most powerful force in the world. The most powerful force in the world. Love can do anything. And the deal in AA, what we do with love, and I heard it said so many times, it was told to me in so many different ways, love through the steps is the process whereby we lead you gently back to yourself. And you come to know you for the first time. And that's what happens here. You take these steps, and through love, you're led gently back to yourself. And then you come to the realization, hey, my head's telling me these things, but this is not who I am. Who I am is so much more than I can imagine. And so that conflict, if you will, of, you know, early Catholicism, and that's all basically. I go to meetings and people say, well, you know, I was raised in a Baptist household, and you know how that is, and I was raised in a Pentecostal, it was the same deal. And the deal is that you were told, we were all told, what to believe. And the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous is so attractive, even if you don't know what's attracting you, but what's attracting you is it's constantly saying, go and do what? Get your own experience. That's how you come to know truth. You experience it. Even down to the very basic question, are you an alcoholic? Does the book tell you you're an alcoholic? It says no. If you think you're not an alcoholic, what should you do? Go next door, pick up a drink, and try to drink. And try it what? More than once. Until you have that experience. Today, you know, we live in a society where everybody's being diagnosed constantly. You do something three times, you need therapy. You better get into that, you know, you need a seminar, you need a book, you need to go here. I like to gamble. Somebody said to me, do you think you're a compulsive gambler? And I said, only when I lose. You know, then I think I'm compulsive. But the whole point is that we're quick to do what? We're quick to jump in with an evaluation. And that's why I believe, and it comes into this third step too, and in all the steps, is that if you're going to have a sponsor should be a good listener. Shouldn't be someone who's constantly telling you what to do. It's someone who listens. Because most of the time, you don't know what's going on in your own head. And you don't know it until you talk it out, until you can hear yourself say it. That's why we let people share at all levels of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because we know sooner or later they'll forget themselves and tell the truth. You know, and it just pops out. And you'll hear them say, I didn't mean to share that. But that's the deal. You know, that's why we let them share. Okay, anything else on step three? Yes, ma'am.
Okay, you know, I work with him. He's pretty new, but the kind of spiritual abuse he had as a young girl is really in their way. My father, like, could quite quote the scriptures as he comes to, and in one incident, the kids found a handgun in the house. And so he took them in the backyard and quoted scripture, and then got the dog. So,
wow.
He really has a hurdle with that. So he's been using our mother instead of our father.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it doesn't make any difference. It gets to the same place. Prayer is nothing more than a cry of the heart. That's why, you know, we laugh at meetings when people come in and they say things like, you know, I was in jail. I heard the door slam. And I knew I was in big trouble. And I cried out, what? God, you get me out of this one. And then 2 days later, I was in an AA meeting. How many times have you heard something very similar to that? And that's what prayer is. It's a cry of the heart. And when you cry out, that which is, hears you. There's no way. It doesn't hear you. And that's why you come to meetings and you just listen to the stories. And I sit there and say, you know, you couldn't write these scripts. You couldn't write these. People say they're too wild. You know, your imagination's run wild. And yet we hear them all the time. But God is your one desire. You know what I would do with that young lady? And this is a suggestion. You do what you're comfortable with. And let her do, is take it to the big book and it says, we had to do what with our old ideas? Let go of all our old ideas. Even our ideas about God. I had to leave God to find God. Does that make sense to you? I had to leave my preconceptions of what I thought God was in order to have any chance to go and find God. Which meant I had to become open, I had to become willing, I had to make the decision, and I had to be able to say to myself at all times, there's much more to this than I have the ability to comprehend and understand. I look, as you're here longer, and I don't care whether you're here a week, a month, a year, whatever it is, you'll look back at your own life, and I don't want to scare you if you're new, but what will happen is, your life will not work out the way you would have had it work out. And in reality, it will work out so much better. But if you were to work it out, you'd say, well, in order for me to be happy, joyous, and free, I've got to have this. And you'll probably end up with none of that, whatever it is. And you'll be happier, and you'll wake up in the morning and scratch your head about that. You say, gosh, you know, had I drawn the game plan, I would have drawn this stuff into it. I have none of that stuff, and yet it's worked out so much better. And that happens over and over and over again. Yes?
I'm
Yeah, Baba.
And along that same line, my sister found me and told me, when you realize that you have nothing left but God, is for the first time you realize that God is enough.
That's all. Yeah, that's right. You see, the concept of God isn't real hard to understand if you're willing to give up on your ego. That's the whole deal. You know, the Hindu tell a great story of this little guy who ran around looking for God. And one day he went to this guy after looking for years and he said, I'm looking for God. And the guy said, I know where he lives. He lives right down that street. Up those three steps is where God lives. So he ran down, he ran up the three steps, he's just about ready to knock on the door, and the thought comes to him, see, thinking. He says, if I knock on this door, and God answers, I will cease to exist. So he quietly took his shoes off and tiptoed down the steps, put them back on, and spent the rest of his life looking for God. See, people are afraid to do that. I mean, I heard some, one time I was in a state institution for 4 years, so I had lots of time to read. And one of the things I read was how some of these great mystics, and a mystic by definition is someone who knows God by experience, not by philosophy, but by experience. And this one mystic, John of the Cross, talked about there's a fire, and God is the fire. And those of us who are really wanting God walk through the fire. And we get burned and mutilated to the point that we can never go back to what we were. We're completely destroyed of ever going back to what we were. The rest of us get close to the fire and we feel the heat and we're afraid to be burned. So we spend our lives staying as close to the fire as possible to feel the heat, but never venturing to get burned. And that's the way I see a lot of people come into the program. It's like, I want what you have, but I don't want to do what you did. How do I do it? I want to get where you are, but I don't want to do any of that stuff you did. You know? So how do we do it? Where do we start? And I said, gosh, you know, that's a great question. Let's start right here at step one. And that's how you go through it. See, we just, most of us don't know that we don't know. And there are some of us then who know that we don't know, but we don't want to find out either. Because whatever it is we have is familiar. And when you start pursuing God full time, every day, it means you leave land and you go out where it's very risky. Because that's what it is. It's very risky. And people make it sound real pleasant, like, oh yes, you just float out and God will... No. God is not the calm little storm, it's a big wind. And it just consumes you. If you're ready to go, it'll consume you. And you have to be willing to give up who you are. And that's where most of us, you know, we want what's there, but we don't want to leave here. And that's the eternal conflict, you know. As I said last night, God is always doing what? Calling us to come sow it, and our minds are cowards, and we don't go. And that's the conflict. The conflict is that inner feeling that this is what I should do, and this head full of knowledge saying what? Don't go. That's why I always tell people that, from my experience, knowledge informs. Knowledge informs. That's all it can do. But spiritual truth transforms. You cannot help but go. You cannot help but go. Anyone else on step three? Yes?
When alcoholic. I found for me that when I gave, I too had the punishing God, and I was afraid that if I gave it up, and again, what I perceived, if I turned my will and my life over to the sheriff daddy, he was going to put me in the Sahara Desert passing out pamphlets, because that was my conception of what a spiritual or religious person was, and if you had God, then you were therefore religious, I was welcome to. Well, what I found for me is that I had to give up, when I gave up the punishing God, I also had to give up the rewarding God.
Okay.
And I hear a lot of, you go to meetings and I really need to get a job, so I ask God to do it. You know, and you sit in meetings all day, and that wasn't, I looked for that when I first got here. I thought, gee, it's going to be wonderful. I'm going to come and roll my life over to the care of God. I'm going to get everything I want. And I didn't. I got a lot of growth experiences or living experiences to go through that were real painful. But again, what the gentleman said and what he said about faith was where I had to start. Mm-hmm. But I had to give up both, not only the punishing God, which I was willing to give up, and the hardest part for me was giving up the rewarding part of mm-hmm. what I thought God was.
Yes, Bernie.
I'm Bernie. I'm now hot.
Hi, Bernie.
For me, I went through the half Irish and alcoholic
gap. Oh, you're a half measure, huh?
I went through the same process of the punching God. Until I came to this program and I found him. Just exactly what he's really supposed to be. And now, today, when I go to Mass, I practice my religion, and I really practice it now. See, I was telling my friend here, when I was a little fella, got a bunch of that.
Mm-hmm.
And those nuns, I hated those white hands. But I had to go. I had to go to parochial school. And when I moved away to a little town where there wasn't a Catholic church, I rode 9 miles each way on my bicycle every Saturday when the rest of the kids were out playing and everything. Bernard had to get on his bicycle early in the morning and go to Auroraville to religious catechism. Get ready for his confirmation. A punishment.
Yeah.
But there's punishing God in
there.
I hated him all the way over and all the way back. But anyhow, I guess when I come to this program, I found out this is exactly what God is supposed to do. And now when I go to church, I can re-program right into that church. It's a way of life.
Mickey?
I'm Mickey. I'm an alcoholic. I had the same personal background too, and when I came here, I learned that I had now not trust God and trust anybody. And I had a try. When I started, I thought, I learned that, just because I came out of a Catholic family, that I didn't have to take care of. Now, if I'd been born in another part of the country, maybe I'd have been bound down to cows or something else. So it started making sense because I could pick my own. But then I had to test it. I started out saying, okay, this little one, I'm going to turn this over to God and see how it handles it. And I want it fixed by Wednesday. And I really needed the process. And as God started showing me that I could trust him with the little ones, I started giving him the bigger ones. you know, and it's so neat today because, you know, I'm practicing it over and over and over today. It's like, God. And when I try to turn it over, it's not a matter of stress. You know, or when I do turn it over, it's not a matter of stress in my mind. And if I don't, it's the only little area in my life that I feel like. Today is so beautiful for me because my idea of God is all He wants is to do things for me. You know, to love and life. And it's so much simpler.
Yes, sir. You got it.
I enjoy being on that one. I have one question, and I'm in the process of finding my God, and what I want to know is, it's real important to have a special place. And in my apartment, I'm going to have a whole room designated for my God. Is that could be a way to find that? I can want to buy them, set myself up to find them, just like a special room designated. I put a king first before, you know, anything else in the home.
Well, you do whatever you want to do. Yeah, you try whatever you want to try. You know, I find out that God to me isn't a special place to me. It's not a special person. It's not. It's like the air I breathe. It's everywhere. And the reality of that to me is the fact then that I don't have to venture anywhere and wonder if God is there. Yeah. You can do whatever you want. That's the nice part about it. Try it. See how it works for you. Yeah. 5 or 10 years from now, you may replace them with a sofa and 2 easy chairs because you're more comfortable. You know, it's like, you know, it's amazing sometimes how we feel that trying to find God is like a pressure situation. And it's not. It's an easy situation. God is right there. And as I said last night, finding God is just making that quantum leap. It's not a step, it's a quantum leap. It's like the guy on the trapeze who swings out and he lets go. And he knows that what? He's going to do a double tumble fast in the air and the guy on the other bar is going to swing out and catch him. And after a while, to make it really exciting, they'll do it without a net. And that's what God is for me, it's working without a net. You know, I know that from past experiences, you see, I have the advantage of what the old timers used to say to me in the early days, and that is, they used to say one word over and over again, Ken, we have continuity. And I said, oh, isn't that impressive? You have continuity. But that's what it was. They had 3, 4, 5, 8, 10 years of having done this, and what they had seen is their life got better and better, and their whole total connection with everything around them got better and better just by doing these simple steps.
One other thing is, I'm failing to think, I know God's everywhere, and I can see the miracles every day. But as far as that, I have a real problem with willingness. That's the key. And as far as that goes, I want to feel like a step in willingness.
Yeah.
So, I just think the one that I don't know, to get kind of fool on.
Yeah. The right track for you is whatever you think you should do. That's the right track. And then you'll come to your own realization, this is good for me or it's not good for me. Then you'll go to a meeting sometimes, I don't know why he's having difficulty with that because you would have already reached that point, you know. It's like the Russians, when they took over in Russia, the Orthodox religion was so ingrained in the people that they wanted them all to become atheists. So they built a little temple. And these guys supposedly went in and said, I don't believe, I don't believe, I don't believe. Then they went home and they found out they still believed. So they went the next day, I don't believe, I don't believe, I don't believe. And then one day on the way home, the guy comes to the realization, I don't believe, thank God. So it's like, how do you get there? Anybody else? We'll go back. Yeah. Yeah, I'm not shutting any of down, but it's comical because when Linda and I were walking over, I said, how long is this supposed to go? Because Charlie just kind of hit me with this, and I thought it was an hour. And I said, well, geez, you know, we can get through the steps in an hour and a half. And then she said, 3 hours. And, you know, I almost made an accident in my shirt. 3 hours. And now, like, we're on step 2, and it's 10 after 10. And now I'm worried about, are we going to get through here? Thanks, Tom.
My name is Dylan. Yeah. I'm quite a survivor. And I'm riding a tandem bike.
Mm-hmm.
Before I was riding, my dad got behind me. He was always with me. I just didn't want him to be there. Now he's driving. I still have to pay.
Mm-hmm.
We still belong
to
people who have gifts that I need. And then as we go to other people, I get to get some. I try to keep the bike going. It's turned over, but there's still some pedaling behind that.
Sure. It's amazing how we all come to our own little deal in that area, and they all work. You know, they all work. You can, as Bernie mentioned, you can get back into your own formal religion, and it, you know, and it works. Because, as I said last night, I've seen and heard people share so many times. I was coming home. I was driving the same old beat-up car. I was coming to the same stinky job. I was going to the same house. I was going to the same spot. But somehow now it was all different. And it's amazing you hear people talk about, it's okay. Well, that's that little place inside of you where God lives. It's okay. And when it's okay, you're okay. And if it's not okay, it doesn't make any difference what's going on around you. You're not okay. That's why we have great sayings in LA that get you out of the mind, like, rocket it into the fourth dimension. You know, I'm a rocket ride. Yeah! You know? And you know, you keep going on these words, and these guys who wrote them down, you say, God, they were so in touch with such a simplistic way of doing things that you wonder today how we get so complicated. When I see the literature table, it used to be like, you know, the big book, and it was the big book and the 12 and 12, and it was the big book, the 12 and 12, and the good old boy, and then it was this Bill Caesar, and it was Larry Caesar, and Merle Caesar, and Joe Caesar, and now we got preached by everybody telling you how they see it, which is okay. I mean, I'm not arguing with any of that stuff, but the thing is that the big book is so simplistic, and it's so simplistic, nobody wants to read it. It's like, well, I read it two or three times, Cam, you know, I read it. Now it's time to get something new, you know, and we're always looking for something new, and the reality is this book covers all the bases. About what our program is about. It is our program. And the rest of it is just an interpretation of what hopefully goes on in that big book. Okay, step four. We're done with step four. Everybody cheer? Okay. Guy will be levitating soon. You can always tell when you're at a spiritual meeting because you say to somebody, is that chair saved? And they say, no, but we're working on it. You know? Okay. Step four. Who's going to read that one? Well, that's it. Volunteer to read? Yes. Okay. Now, what does that mean?
Oh, shit.
Oh, shit. That's exactly what it means. Oh, shit. That's very good. I was so close to the point, and it summed up everything. Oh, shit. Yeah. And she said, no, honey, your shit. Yeah, okay. And what do you do in step four? I mean, now we got like another thing. We have reams and reams of books working from the animal kingdom down to inanimate objects. So the deal is like, what do we do in step four? What does the book say to do?
Make a list.
Okay, what kind of a list? Checking it twice. So things you resented, alright? Like a resentment list, okay? Made a moral inventory. I mean, is this really that complex? Seems like the more we talk about it, the more complex it gets. But is it really that complex? It's the stuff that bothers you reduced to paper so you can do what? Get rid of it. Share it with someone and get rid of it. It's like, you know, somebody says, well, did I do it right? How can you do it wrong? Did you leave out stuff that bothers you? Then it should be down there. But if you can't remember, what about the stuff I can't remember? I know there must be more. I can't remember. What about the stuff I didn't block out? Come on, you know, some of these questions are self-answering. You can't remember, how am I going to help you with it? Melon, Larry, September the 4th, you know. So the deal is you reduce down to paper those things that bother you so as to get them out once and for all and to look at them factually without making up a scenario that complements our interpretation. Right? You know? we don't want to put it together so that we come out looking like we did something good. You know, I sponsored a guy when he first got here. He said his partner robbed $250,000 from him. And when he took his 5-year kick, he said his partner had robbed $100,000 from him. And he just took a 10-year kick and he robbed $70,000 from that guy. You know? So, more will be revealed, you know? So, you know, some people are totally incapable at a point in time to admit that they're wrong. And there's no sense beating them over the head for that. If they're totally incapable of doing it, then what does that mean? They're totally incapable of doing it. But you try to get down and reduce to paper those things that bother you, which cause you to lay awake at night and look at the ceiling and give you a lot of discomfort. And you try to get those reduced to paper. And the whole thing is to reduce it to paper so you can see it out in the open instead of down here hidden. And then the next step just ties right in with it. You do what?
Get rid of it.
You get rid of it. You know, I love Mexican food, but Mexican food does not love me. You know, so I always say the fifth step is like Mexican food. The quicker you get out of your system, the better off you're going to feel. You know, I just get it out. And that's the reality. You get it out. And the whole purpose of sharing it with someone else is to do what? Come on, now what's the whole purpose here? What's your fifth principle there? You what? Integrity. You get a chance to say for once and for all, this is what I did. I'm not proud of it. Given the same circumstances, hopefully I wouldn't do it again. But that's where I was at the time, and this is what I did. And when you share it with another person, and the whole reason for sharing it with another person is to give you some sense of humility and integrity. If you just keep it and share it with God, like you're letting God in on a secret. It's so that at least one person gets to know you as you really are, so that down the road when you start to have a little windage problem and drift, they're able to say to you, hey, you know, that's like old ideas coming back. And so the whole idea is to give you a sense of humility and also to take you and deflate you a little bit, take some air out of that balloon. And that's the whole process here, is to take the air out of the balloon and allow the balloon to just be at rest and be totally comfortable instead of being stretched out every other day. Anybody want to make anything else out of that? Going once. Going twice. Okay, step six. Good five in about a minute, huh? You got to go faster now. It's like we've got to catch the subway here. So we're moving now, sweetie. You blink your eyes, we can be through this. Okay. Step six, what is it? Hello? Huh?
Became willing
to do what?
We're entirely ready to have God remove all these
defects. Oh, okay. Good. We're entirely ready. What about you, Tim? When that moment in life came, you said, God, I'm entirely ready.
I was sort of ready on the basis of just, you know, if it's easy, I'll do it.
Okay.
But entirely ready, I seem to struggle with every step to get into it.
Create the feeling.
Yes.
Okay. So the deal is what I hear you saying is that most of us, when the pain gets so intense that it calls for some action, then I'll humbly submit to the action suggested. Okay. All right. Does anyone have anything extra to add to that? Do we need a bathroom break or something? Do you do something?
I'm going to do something about...
You were going to do it personally?
Get into 7.
Oh, okay. Okay. All right, so the deal is that you're entirely ready. When again, those words, entirely ready. When you're ready, you're ready. Only the book says to do what? Be entirely ready. It's like letting go what? Absolutely. You notice there's a lot of redundancy in this? You don't know who you're going to be working with or what? Let go, absolutely. Entirely ready. I mean, and when you're ready, you're ready. But he had to put in that word what? Entirely ready. Because he knew some alcoholic would say, well, I'm almost ready. I'm semi-ready. You know? I'm getting ready. Do you ever notice people that when they don't want to change, that's what they do? They constantly get ready to change? You know, like, I know I need to change. I want to change. I feel the compulsion to change. I'm inventorying change. I'm sharing at meetings about change. I talk to my sponsor about change. And he said, holy God, are you ever going to get to this bitterness? And the reality is that's the ego. We do not let go of old ideas easy. We hold on to them because they're familiar. You know, it's like the Al-Anon said one night. She said she was at a meeting and she heard a woman share. And the sharing went something like this. He sits on the couch and he has no intimacy with me or the children. He's constantly condemning me. He's abusive at every opportunity. All he does is watch sports. He seldom works. He contributes nothing to the household. What's the problem? I'm afraid he's going to leave. You know? You say, wait a second. Go to 38 and help him. You know, like that. Check him out. But if that's what the mind sees, like I say, if I give up this bus, there may not be another bus along. And so we hold on to that stuff. And this is what? Saying we're entirely ready to allow God to do this for us, to remove these defects. Now you can again spend copious amount of time getting ready. But I find out that pain is a great motivator. When people are hurting, you know, I usually say to my professors, well, when should I do this step? Well, I equate it with going out to your car, opening the door, and closing it on your hand. Like, when do you want to open the car door? You know, you want to relieve that pain as quickly as possible. And it's amazing how we are so conditioned to pain, particularly that inward personal pain, that we are slow. As Tim said, you have to kind of get ready to do the step. You know, you get ready to do each and every step. But here we become entirely ready to allow God to do it. And then what do we do at that point when we're entirely ready? What do we do? Scott, come on, Scott. What do we do?
We do it.
Okay. How do you do it?
Pray.
Okay. That's one way. What else do you do? What else do you do? What's the book say to do?
Humbly.
Humbly. Oh, another word, humbly. Something alcoholics relate to well. Humbly. I'm very humble. Yeah. Humbly. Okay. The deal here is that if you're following along in a spiritual line, you are growing towards a crescendo. You are going through these steps, and each step is taking you that much closer to that place where you want to go. And it means, as I say all the time, going away you've never gone. We are now involved in a process of getting to a place we've never been, and we get there by a route we've never traveled. You know, the old timers used to say things like, alcoholics are climbing a mountain that nobody else sees. And it's like scaling any mountain. As you start out at the bottom, you take along a lot of stuff that you think you'll need. You know? And as you get up into the higher altitudes, now, step 6 and 7, what happens is it's a thinning out process. You know that if you're going to go on, you're going to have to do what? Leave more and more behind. Otherwise, you're never going to get to those heights you want to go to. So it's getting rid of that stuff. Some of it we can get rid of directly through 4 and 5. Then we get to 6, and it's some of this stuff that to us, for whatever reason, we know we should be rid of, but we're not ready to let go. And so we ask God to intervene. And we ask God to do for us what we're unable to do for ourselves. And that is to relieve us of this bondage of self so we can go to these higher altitudes. Now we're where?
Making a list.
Making a list. Okay. We're on step what now? Step 8. Okay. Yes. Okay. Okay, why don't we take a 10-minute break? And this way you can release yourself.
Get rid of those things.
This concludes take 1. Please go on to take number 2 for the continuation of Kent's 12-step study.